This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, will a diverse show start a trend of more color on television? And a Latino gang is accused of targeting African Americans. Joining us today to discuss these topics and more from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Joe Davidson. He's an editor at the Washington Post. Also there, Republican strategist Tara Setmeyer. And with us is Nat Urban, Urban, professor of future study at Wake Forest University. He joins us from member station WFDD in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Welcome to you all. We wanted to talk about something that ABC brought to light this week in a report they did about discrimination in the workplace, this against parents. They referenced a Cornell University study which showed that if, in fact, job applicants were placed side by side, a mother would have a 44% less likely chance of being hired than a non-mother. And if hired, she would be paid $11,000 less than the person without a child. Joe Davidson, we also know that in the past decade we've seen employment discrimination suits decline, but there's been a 400% increase in family responsibility discrimination suits. This, of course, in the face of the Family and Medical Leave Act.
And some people are calling this the maternal wall instead of, or perhaps in addition to, the glass ceiling. And I think it's the kind of thing that employers are really starting to become aware of, if for no other reason that they don't want to be sued. There have been a number of cases in recent years in which people have taken their employers to court because they've been denied jobs or promotions or fired after they take time off to tend to family responsibilities. And so now this is now being known as family responsibility discrimination. And I know the trade publications are starting to take account of this in order to alert their clients that they need to add such things into their anti-discrimination codes, as we do not discriminate against employers or prospective employees because of their family status or family situation or the need to take time off for family responsibilities.
And Nat Urban, those of us who are parents understand and know that this isn't just with the birth of the child. This is ongoing when you have to go to a particularly important soccer game or a science fair or something of that nature. And with the growing sense of two-family household or two-parent households working, this seems to me something that one would have believed employers would have taken a look at some time ago.
Absolutely, Ed. In fact, that was my sentiment when I read the story, that this seems to me to be a spike that just kind of came out of nowhere. It seems like it's the last gasp of a very old perspective that we had about families in the workplace. Today, more than half of all married couples, both spouses, work, and more than half of all married couples in the U.S. house in the United States. That's according to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. And I think when you look at the future, in fact, one stat that really struck me as I thought about this story is that if you were a parent, if you were a child born since 1980, you more than likely will spend more time taking care of your mother, your parents, than your parents spent taking care of you. And this, of course, reflects the aging of our society. And I think, you know, there's also another study done that seems to contradict what this study says.
And when you say that, Nat, we should note that that's one-on-one contact.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
And what's happening is what 2 points. One is that there's another study that suggests, and I think this is much more reflective of the way that Americans feel about family and work, is that more companies, even those that are not covered by the Federal Medical Leave Act, more companies are more sympathetic nowadays toward families having responsibilities, you know, when a parent gets sick or a child, or you have some responsibility to take care of, that employers are more likely to give the employees time off. Even smaller companies that are not covered by the Federal Medical Leave Act are trying to accommodate this. So I see this particular study or this blip in the increase of discrimination is something just temporary. Long term, I think Americans recognize the importance of balancing family and responsibility. After all, employees who are not happy at home are much more subject to employee turnover, and that costs business the bottom line.
And Tara, we should note that this is something in terms of when two parents are in the home, particularly for African Americans and other minorities in this country, goes to the issue of being problematic even more so, since the dual income is even more important to African Americans and minorities in this country oftentimes.
Absolutely, and I think that Professor Irvin hit the nail on the head describing the way that companies, for the most part, have recognized that we do live in a new era where you have more two-parent households and that they need to be more flexible concerning family responsibilities. And you have examples with telecommuting, flex time. You see more companies instituting these options, giving working parents the ability to change their hours or work from home. But something else, I think, that the family, a result of the Family Medical Leave Act, is an increase in women-owned businesses, because it's allowing women, some women now have thought about, well, maybe we should start our own business. And there's been quite an increase, double-digit increase in women-owned businesses over the past about 6-7 years. And I think that this has also empowered women to go ahead and they can be the boss, so they're not under the constraints of corporate America, where they can set their own rules. Women-owned businesses employ almost 18 million people in this country, and I think that is a positive coming out of a potential negative.
Yeah, and as women ascend the corporate ladder, obviously the understanding of motherhood and the importance of it grows in terms of the corporate understanding. But Joe Davidson, before we leave this topic, what is problematic is the people that perhaps need it most, those on the lower rungs of the economic ladder, really don't see the relief oftentimes even when corporate America makes these policies. They don't often drift down to the lower worker as much as they do the corporate executive, for instance.
Well, I think like in many other things in our society, the people who are in the lower rungs of the economic ladder often might not have the same level of information, the same amount of education, the same amount of organization, the same level of advocacy on their behalf. And so they often do not get the benefits that are out there for everybody because they are not in the same position to aggressively take advantage of those benefits. And I also think it's true that while the kinds of situation family responsibility we're talking about today falls primarily on women in our society, there are a number of men who find themselves in this same situation. There was a lawsuit, a case called Schultz versus Advocate Healthcare and Hospital Corporation in 2002, where a man got $11 million settlement or $11 million award because he was terminated basically as a result of his leave to care for his elderly parents. So I think that this is a situation that extends across gender lines, across economic and education lines, and I think it's finally getting much more attention.
Well, I just really quickly, I think that state legislatures are recognizing this as well, because 27 states are now considering paid leave acts to complement the Federal Medical Leave Act, because there are a lot of gaps. It just allows for time off, not necessarily paid time off. So I think that legislatures around the country are recognizing that there are gaps that need to be filled as well.
All right, let's take a look at another issue this week. Federal prosecutors are taking a look at a Los Angeles area gang, the Avenues. This is a Latino gang, a large Latino gang in the Los Angeles area, and whether or not over the course of a number of years from 1994 to 2000 that they conspired to kill African Americans on their, quote, turf. The question that's interesting as federal prosecutors pursue this case, Nat Irvin, is whether or not this is simple turf gang warfare, or whether or not these are hate crimes being committed by Latinos against African Americans.
Well, Ed, I tell you the truth, I can't tell the difference myself, but my sentiments are with the federal prosecutors. Whatever it takes to put these folks in jail for the rest of their lives, do it. And you know, it's 2006, and of course this happened a little bit before now. But you know, it's a frightening kind of thing to think in terms of gangs singling out a particular group of people for harassment. The same kinds of ways that the KKK, or other hateful groups used to discriminate against blacks or to target blacks. It's a frightening kind of thing. But at the same time, we have to be careful to not generalize about Latinos and blacks just based on what gangs are doing. Most folk don't identify. If you're a black person, I'd say this, that most folks don't identify in general with gang behavior. It's a statistical anomaly within our communities, and it behooves us not to take what has happened in the prisons, you know, the tension that exists between mm-hmm. black gangs and Latino gangs in the prisons. And then now, of course, we see what happens on the outside. It behooves us to be careful not to generalize between Latinos and blacks and the larger community.
Many see this as a spillover from what happens in prison, the division of gangs by race. But Joe Davidson, one of the important issues here is as the federal government goes after these men and women in these gangs, the defense attorneys are suggesting that the federal government has no power to involve itself in a common street crime. They're trying to paint this as a common street crime because they understand if it is painted and seen as a hate crime for these defendants, it's going to be harsher time.
Well, I think the defense attorneys might have a hard time in court with that argument, because the federal government has very broad reach, and they have broad reach through gun laws. As a result of crime legislation passed in the 90s, practically any crime committed with a gun can somehow run afoul of federal gun laws. And there's also statutes depriving one of his or her civil rights, through homicide, for example. So there are definitely avenues that the feds can use to get into this. And then they can attach the hate crimes if they deem it appropriate, and if the court and the jury go along with that. And there was this, and while sometimes it might be difficult to tell whether this is a simple turf battle that could be between, say, two Latino gangs or two black gangs, or whether it does have a racial or ethnic element, that does take another level of proof. But in mm-hmm. one case, the FBI claims that an order, and this goes back to 1998, came from the Mexican mafia in prison with the order to kill any blacks on sight. Well, any blacks, that doesn't mean a rival gang. That's any blacks. Right. So if that's the case, then I think in this particular situation, the Fed certainly could make a case for it that it's a hate crime.
And Tara, what Joe suggests there is what I was going to bring up, in the idea that they don't have to be mutually exclusive. We could see both tracks running.
That's true, and my concern with this is the overreaching of the federal government into state affairs. I think that is, unfortunately, the defense of these despicable individuals is what is using this argument, and I don't think under any circumstances they should be let go or taken easy on. I think gang culture is a multifaceted problem that requires multifaceted approaches, but I am concerned with the overreaching of the federal government in its application of hate crimes and getting involved in state and local issues. However, if that's what needs to happen, then that's what we need to break up some of these these gangs, then so be it. However, I am always leery of hate crimes, because why should murder, and last time I checked, is inherently a hateful act. And just because they're murdering these individuals because they're black, or they're beating them because they're black, or vice versa, shouldn't make the crime any worse because the person is still losing their life. So I think there's also another debate there discussing whether hate crimes are valid or not.
Okay, well, we'll save that for another day, since we only have a couple of minutes to go, and I would promise you that would cause more havoc than we can wreak in this last couple of minutes.
Isn't that
my
job?
It is, Tara. Thank you so much.
Always time for more havoc.
Let me do this very quickly, if I can. Emmy nominations, primetime Emmy nominations this week. Grey's Anatomy, a big winner with 23 nominations, second only to 24. The hit television show, and it may have been 13. I get my numbers mixed up here, but nonetheless, they received a whole bunch of nominations, second only to 24. But here's the question, and our congratulations to Sandra Rhimes, who is the creator and executive producer and a friend to this program of Grey's Anatomy, an African-American woman. This is a truly diverse cast in a town that is clearly driven by trends. One would believe, now that Grey's Anatomy has been such a big hit, one would hope that we would see a trend to move to more diverse dramas and the like on television. But Nat, fast and easy money would say we're not going to see that if you believe the history of Hollywood.
Well, but the demographics of the future are different than the demographics of the past of Hollywood, Ed. And so I'd say that this portends very well for the future. And the other thing I'd say, anytime you're nominated for an Emmy, whether you receive or not, your calls are a lot. It's, you know, people tend to return your calls if it starts, if your name has Emmy nominee behind it. So anytime you can have success of this kind, and I congratulate the producers and all the actors for their success, it's got to be better for the future. And still, though, it's not just the credentials, it is the demographics of the future that I think also makes this possible.
Joe, are you that optimistic? And I should note, I found my notes. It's 11 nods to Grey's Anatomy. All right,
I'm
Joe,
not
you
quite
that
optimistic.
I'm not.
I think the demographics argument makes sense, but I also pay attention to history. And I think history teaches us that it's a very long and slow process, even after you win awards. Look at all of the attention, for example, Waiting to Exhale received, and that was seen as a breakthrough movie. Have we really seen a lot coming from that? I don't think so.
All right, Tara, real quick for me, about 30 seconds.
Well, yeah, I think it demonstrates that Hollywood moves very slowly when it comes to minority inclusion. And thankfully, we have an African-American writer that's producing a quality program that is not necessarily racially specific. So that goes to show you that black folks are actually capable of writing things and producing quality work that's not necessarily about black people. And another example in Hollywood is how there's actually no black executives in movie studios that can green light a project.
Yeah.
And given the popularity of movies that are geared toward African Americans, that's a startling statistic as well. So I think that's a telling one.
Well, if you just take a look at the nominees, save just a couple, two, including two from Grey's Anatomy, it is still very much a lily white game in Hollywood on television and on the big screen.
Well,
so
one analysis said prime time is white time.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a 24 fan, so I'm partial.
Yeah, I'm a 24
fan, Tara, too. Nat, Joe, thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
You too.